content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the December 17th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a Planned Parenthood clinic. It is boarded up, the windows and doors, with a big closed sign on the front door. There's a woman, of color, standing in the parking lot. She's wearing a hoodie and has a purse slung over her shoulder. She's got her head bent a little bit and into her hands. Looks like a sad scene. The headline is, "When Clinics Close, How Would Overturning Roe Affect Women, Politics, and a Bitterly Divided Nation?" And we'll get to that a little bit later, but our first main story is Omicron data points to need for boosters. What happened? The Omicron variant was spreading rapidly this week in the U.S. and the world, amid troubling new evidence that it may greatly reduce protection conferred by two-shot vaccinations and prior infection. But Pfizer reported that lab tests showed that people who receive booster shots may be highly protected against serious illness from Omicron. And there were some tentative indications that the variant may cause less severe illness for most people. In South Africa, where the variant was first detected, Omicron sent new daily cases surging from fewer than 300 a month ago to more than 16,000. But doctors noted that the case explosion hasn't led to an equivalent rise in hospitalizations, suggesting Omicron may cause milder illness. Experts caution that South Africa's population skews young and severe disease takes time to develop. Still, the signals are a bit encouraging regarding severity, said White House Health Advisor Anthony Fauci. Lab tests by South African researchers showed antibodies in the blood of vaccinated people were far less effective against Omicron infections than against previous variants. Another analysis found that Omicron was three times more likely to cause reinfection in people who'd had COVID than were previous variants. The good news was that lab results released by Pfizer and BioNTech showed that three doses of its vaccine provided a high level of protection against Omicron, comparable to the effectiveness of two doses against earlier strains. "The results are very, very encouraging," said President Biden. "They suggest that if you get the booster, you're really in good shape." What the editorial said. "Once again, we enter a new phase of pandemic uncertainty," said San Jose Mercury News. "Omicron has already spread to 21 states, and with conflicting signals and weeks to come before we have solid answers in hand about the nature of the new variant, we don't know how concerned we should be. But we already know how to protect ourselves and our communities. Wear high-quality masks in public indoor spaces, practice social distancing, and get a booster shot. As we gear up to combat a new enemy, these tactics remain the leading weapons in our arsenal." "We all want the pandemic to be over," said the Houston Chronicle, "but the only way it ever will be is for each of us to do our part. Above all, that means vaccination. If you've been holding out, now's the time, even if you were previously infected. If you've gotten two doses, get a booster as soon as possible. And vaccinate your kids," said immunologist Peter Hotez. "If you don't, you're asking for trouble." What the columnist said. "So here we go again," said Andreas Kluth in Bloomberg.com. "We're fully 2 years into the COVID pandemic, and once again, we're confronting a new wave of uncertainty. As the holidays loom, should we soldier on with our lives undaunted or beat a retreat? We need answers, and as scientists chase them, all we can do is wait. Let's not sugarcoat what's coming, said former CDC Director Tom Frieden in CNN.com. We're already in the midst of a major Delta surge in the Midwest and other states, and now Omicron is likely to bring another wave of infections. Whether we like it or not, it's shaping up to be a hard winter. There are promising signs that Omicron infections may mean milder cases, said David Spiegelhalter and Anthony Masters in The Guardian. But it's far more transmissible than even Delta. An explosion in infections will inevitably put more COVID patients in overwhelmed hospitals. While the nation braces for the unknowns of Omicron, we still don't have control of Delta, said Finit Nerapil and Brittany Shamas in the Washington Post. The U.S. logged more than 2,000 COVID deaths the first day of December, the most in 2 months. As people travel for the holidays and gather indoors, a winter surge already underway may worsen. At St. Cloud Hospital in Minnesota, doctors are still deep in battle with Delta, facing a steady barrage of incoming patients, most of them unvaccinated. We just continue to see rail car after rail car pile into this derailment, said COVID response coordinator George Morris. Omicron is a whole other train coming right behind a wreck. The controversy of the week is Michigan school shooting, when parents give kids guns. Oh, how he loved that gun, said Tony Norman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. On Black Friday, when his father bought a semi-automatic Sig Sauer SP-2022 for him and in a sale, Ethan Crumbly, 15, posted a photo of the weapon online, captioned, "My new beauty." The next day, his mother took him shooting, proudly posting about her son's new Christmas present. And on Tuesday, Ethan took his new beauty from his parents' unlocked bedroom drawer and killed 4 classmates and wounded 7, including a teacher at Michigan's Oxford High School. Crumbly is now in jail on murder and terrorism charges. His parents have been arrested and charged with involuntary manslaughter for their negligence. School officials share in the blame, said Mitch Album, in the Detroit Free Press. The day before the shooting, a teacher caught Ethan shopping for ammunition on his phone. The morning of the shooting, another teacher found a drawing on Ethan's desk of a bleeding gunshot victim beside the words, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me." No one did. At a meeting in the principal's office with his parents present, the adults in the room didn't search Ethan's backpack, let alone send him home. They kept him at school, where he soon emerged from a bathroom with his Christmas present in his hand. Nothing ever seems to change after these school shooting nightmares, said Shannon Watts in the Washington Post. But this time can be different. The decision of Michigan prosecutors to charge Crumbly's parents is a bold move that could actually have an impact. At least 70% of school shootings are committed with guns found at home, so establishing the precedent that secure gun storage is part of being a responsible gun owner could compel parents to lock up their weapons and save many, many lives. Let's take a breath, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. To say the Crumblies showed appalling judgment is an understatement. When the school told Jennifer Crumbly about her son's online bullet shopping, she allegedly texted Ethan, "LOL, I'm not mad at you. You just have to learn not to get caught." But it's the job of legislatures, not prosecutors, to make laws. And Michigan's lawmakers have repeatedly rejected bills that would make it illegal to let kids have unsupervised access to guns. requiring that guns be stored unloaded with a trigger lock in place, as prosecutors claim the Crumbleys should have done, would render guns ineffective for home defense, meaning such laws would face a stiff constitutional challenge. It always comes back to the Second Amendment, said Will Bunch in Inquirer.com. Our legislatures and courts persist in treating that one short, convoluted paragraph about well-regulated militias as something that was delivered by God on a stone tablet, rather than a dusty relic of the 18th century, when there were no semi-automatic weapons capable of inflicting such carnage. As a result, the recurring horror of mass shootings will be part of American life for the foreseeable future. But we need to minimize the number of casualties however we can, with common sense gun safety laws. Yes, and one of them should make parents responsible for keeping guns out of minors' hands, said John Michek in GeorgiaRecorder.com. More cautious parents might have prevented the killings in Michigan, as well as the massacre of 20 children 9 years ago in Newtown, Connecticut, with point-blank slaughter by another troubled young man, officially marked the start of our national acceptance of sacrificing innocence on the false altar of gun rights. It's a good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for getting the band back together. After the members of Omicron, a progressive metal band that broke up in 2016, reported a surge in online interest. We were thinking, should we capitalize on this? Said guitarist Lee Hing Chan. Is it in bad taste? It was a good week for cancel culture. After Counter Conference, an anti-cancel culture event due to be held in London with such controversial right-wing speakers as Britain's Nigel Farage and former Trump advisor Jason Miller, was itself canceled. The reason? Low ticket sales. It was a good week for lockdowns. After Capitol rioter Jen O'Ryan, a Texas realtor who flew to the January 6th insurrection on a private jet, announced that she will use her 60-day jail sentence to lose 30 pounds, detox her system, and really dial in her yoga regimen. If I do that, said Ryan, 50, then it will be worth going to prison. But it was a bad week for a non-binary female deer, which was shot by hunters in Missouri after the doe's impressive 16-point set of antlers caused them to mistake her for a buck. Wildlife experts said that only one doe in 10,000 has this gender-fluid mutation. It was a bad week for hippopotami after two of the massive creatures at Belgium's Antwerp Zoo were diagnosed with COVID. The zoo's vet reported that hippos are so far only suffering from runny noses. And finally, it was a bad week for Paradox after the German Euthanasia Association announced that those seeking to legally end their lives in Germany must now produce proof of COVID vaccination. The organization said the requirement is needed to protect medical staff whose work requires human closeness. The briefing is titled, The War in Orbit. A recent Russian anti-satellite test created a dangerous cloud of space debris and raised the risk of war in space. What was Russia's test? To assess and demonstrate its ability to blow up U.S. satellites, Russia launched a missile from the ground that flew 310 miles up into space and blew up a 2-ton Soviet-era surveillance satellite in low Earth orbit. The explosion created a cloud of shrapnel that will threaten satellites and human in space for decades to come. American, German, and Russian astronauts on the International Space Station, at an orbit 60 miles below the satellite, had to shelter in transport capsules for hours, ready to evacuate in case of collision. The explosion doubled the number of objects in the most highly traveled region of near-Earth orbit, sending 1,500 pieces of debris larger than 2 inches and hundreds of thousands of smaller fragments hurtling around the planet at 17,000 miles per hour, much faster than a bullet. A single paint fleck moving at that speed can severely damage a commercial or government satellite, while a pebble-sized chunk could destroy one or instantly kill an astronaut on a spacewalk. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said he was outraged by this irresponsible and destabilizing action. Why did Russia do this? Russia is not the first state actor to test anti-satellite technology. The U.S., China, and India have all done so in years past. But it is the first to generate so much debris in this highly used level of orbit. As a direct result, every maneuverable object currently in low Earth orbit will have to perform avoidance maneuvers whenever debris comes close, which takes them offline and wastes their fuel. The dollar cost to all actors in space will be immense. Analysts said it's no accident that President Vladimir Putin chose this moment when Russian troops are massing off the Ukrainian border and NATO is threatening sanctions to demonstrate Russia's ability to destroy the satellites the U.S. military relies on to communicate among troops and guide its own bombs to their targets. The test comes against the background of a lot of lower-level Russian aggression in space. What kind of aggression? General David Thompson, second in command of the Space Force, said last week that both Russia and China have been repeatedly launching reversible attacks that temporarily disable but do not destroy U.S. satellites. Many are cyber attacks, while others include jamming satellite signals with competing radio frequency signals and temporarily blinding satellite optics with lasers. Last year, Russia tested a nesting doll satellite that opened up and released a smaller craft capable of shooting a projectile, proof that it is seeking the ability to destroy enemy satellites from space. China, meanwhile, is developing Shenzhen 17, a satellite with a robotic arm designed to grab and disable enemy satellites without blowing them up. The threats are really growing and expanding every single day, Thompson told the Washington Post. We're really at a point now where there's a whole host of ways that our space systems can be threatened. What is vulnerable? There are nearly 3,400 active satellites in orbit. Any one of them is theoretically at risk. These include the military satellites that the U.S. uses for crucial intelligence gathering, such as early warning of nuclear missile launches. Other satellites in low Earth orbit where the Russian test occurred include the Hubble Space Telescope, mapping satellites, and a proliferating number of commercial satellites. Medium Earth orbit contains many navigation satellites, while most of the world's telecommunication and GPS satellites tend to be further up, at 22,000 miles, in geostationary orbit. Russia warned last week that it could destroy 32 GPS satellites, which would cause chaos in the U.S. Can Russia be punished for littering? Probably not. The framework governing the military use of space is the outdated 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which says countries can't station nukes or other weapons of mass destruction in space and requires them to use space without leaving harmful contamination. SpaceX, whose Starlink array of internet satellites is now jeopardized by the Russian debris field, could in theory bring a lawsuit, but there's not much precedent for one. The only time a country paid a price for its actions in space was in 1978, when Russia paid $2.36 million after chunks of a reconnaissance satellite fell to Earth, scattering radioactive material across northern Canada. Will there be a new treaty? Many are now calling for one. Not only is there yet no ban on creating debris, but there isn't even an international system to monitor satellite traffic. Currently, satellite providers voluntarily send emails to alert each other to near passes. Some analysts warn of a future in which the realm beyond Earth's atmosphere becomes so cluttered as to be unusable. If we fail to design rules that prevent our orbital activity from becoming self-defeating and destructive, says former NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen, we will soon find we have squandered another of Earth's greatest resources. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week. Start with, please, Santa, bring us some ammo. Representative Thomas Massie's family Christmas card displays the cruelty, heartlessness, and extremism that has come to define today's GOP, said Dean Obadala. The Republican congressman from Kentucky sent out holiday greetings via Twitter that show his family of seven in front of a decorated tree, each person gleefully holding some type of gun. As a caption to this startling image, Massie writes, Merry Christmas. P.S. Santa, please bring ammo. A bristling display of weaponry to mark the birth of Jesus Christ, known as the Prince of Peace, is grotesque in itself, and is spectacularly ill-timed given that it came just days after the year's deadliest school shooting. When people pointed out that Massie posted his tribute to killing machines and plea for ammo just as four Oxford, Michigan families were making funeral arrangements for their teenage children, Massie wasn't contrite. Instead, he replied with snark and the hashtag sassy with Massie. And Massie isn't an outlier among Republicans. Compassion and humility now appear to be seen as weakness in a party that takes its cue from Donald Trump and his belligerent, inflammatory rhetoric. A shameless lack of humanity has become the party's brand. Why the U.S. lost in Afghanistan? Why did the American war machine crumble in Afghanistan? Asked Richard Hanna. For two decades, the military and a succession of presidents hid from the public how hopeless the mission was. That's the essential takeaway from the Afghanistan Papers, a compilation by the Washington Post's Craig Whitlock of the government's own inspector general's reports on the debacle. The reports show that President George W. Bush lost interest in Afghanistan the moment he decided to invade Iraq. The war was conducted by a poisoned bureaucracy full of self-interested officials who made blunder after blunder. Ending Afghanistan's lucrative opium trade, for example, angered rural Afghans and helped fuel the Taliban insurgencies. For years, the U.S. cynically funneled billions to brutal warlords who would often rape and terrorize the local populations. In 2009, General David McKiernan was fired for being too honest and saying the war was stalemated. The Pentagon pressed on, telling President Obama that we needed to fight on to protect human rights, and telling President Trump of victory in killing bad guys. Most Afghans always knew what Americans didn't. The democracy was supposedly built was a Potemkin village, doomed to collapse. This is from Switzerland. Four languages and English isn't one. The English language is taking over Zurich, said Claudia Schmidt. It was a few years ago that I started to encounter, when dining out in Switzerland's largest city, the occasional waiter who'd respond to my Swiss German with, sorry, English only. Can you repeat, please? At first, it was a fun chance to trot out my English, but now every downtown establishment expects guests to communicate only in English. Indeed, they hand out menus in English. Look, I know Swiss German is a horror language with its hard consonants and numerous obscure dialects, including some I can only understand with subtitles. But the ability to converse in standard German should not be too much to expect in this German-speaking region. Frankly, I'd be fine with conversing in French, Italian, or even Romanche, my country's other national language. But most of our restaurant workers are now foreigners, and they have been trained to work in English. Many Swiss employees left the industry during the months of pandemic shutdowns, and they have been replaced by immigrants. Of course, most Swiss are conversant in English, and it's not a huge hardship to say coffee, please, instead of bitte einen Kaffee. But it's alienating. I was born here, yet who is the guest and who is the host? The title of the last word is The Great Killer Asteroid Crash Test. The near regions of space are filled with small asteroids that could destroy much of a city, said Robin George Andrews in Scientific American. The DART project seeks to keep them from getting to Earth. Back when Andy Rivkin was in college, he had a few friends in medical school. I was like, oh man, I don't want to do anything that has too much responsibility, he said. Instead, he looked to the stars. Astronomy seemed pretty safe. And for a while it was. Rather than having to make decisions about someone's root canal or abdominal surgery, he watched worlds flit about in the darkness. Rivkin, a planetary astronomer at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory in Baltimore, has found himself with more responsibility than he expected. Along with hundreds of others, he is part of the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART, mission, an ambitious effort led by NASA and his lab to slam an unscrewed spacecraft into an asteroid an uncrewed spacecraft into an asteroid to change its orbit. This is a dry run for the real deal. One day, a technological descendant of DART could be used to deflect a planet-threatening space rock, saving millions, perhaps billions, of lives in the process. On November 23rd, DART launched on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from California's Vandenberg Space Force Base. Sometime next fall, it will smash into its target at 24,000 kilometers per hour. Ground-based astronomers like Rivkin will watch the rendezvous unfold with bated breath, hoping to see the telltale signs of success: a dust cloud and an asteroid dancing to humanity's tune for the very first time. Will it work? We don't know what's going to happen because we've never tried it before, said Michelle Bannister, a planetary astronomer at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. Despite the prominence of Texas-sized asteroidal antagonists in Hollywood blockbusters, the biggest rocks are not a cause for much concern among level-headed scientists. Almost all asteroids a kilometer or larger across with orbits approaching Earth have already been found, and none will seriously threaten us in the next few centuries. Like much in life, when it comes to planetary defense, it is the small things that matter. The space rock that exploded in midair over the Russian city of Chelyabinsk on February 15, 2013, was estimated to be just 17 meters long, and yet its blast, equivalent to perhaps 470 kilotons of TNT, unleashed a window-shattering shockwave that injured 1,200 people. It could have been worse. In 1908, what seems to have been a 60-meter meteor detonated above a remote stretch of Siberia, flattening more than 2,000 square kilometers of forest. Imagine that happening over a city or town you live in. Buildings would be reduced to rubble. Debris would fly about in hurricane-force winds, and clothing and flesh alike exposed to the initial scorching flash could burst into flames. It would be comparable to a massive nuclear explosion, minus the radiation. These small impactors are disconcertingly plentiful. Of those at least 140 meters across, models suggest that about 25,000 exist that approach within 190 million kilometers of the sun. Some of these so-called city killer objects may pass unnervingly close to Earth's orbit. And of these diminutive but destructive near-Earth objects, we think we've found less than half, Rivkin says. It is estimated that every century there is a 1% chance of a city killer will impact the Earth. Even if that transpires, most of the planet's surface is ocean, suggesting that a space rock is most likely to land in the middle of nowhere. But if one of them hits any nation, plunges into a country's coastline, or blows up overhead, it could cause one of the worst natural disasters in human history. Any given year, the odds are on our side, but wait long enough and our luck will run out. Hollywood's preferred defense solution, nuclear bombs, probably could work, as high-fidelity simulations have shown that a sufficiently powerful blast could either knock an asteroid out of Earth's way or tear it into harmlessly tiny pieces. Using nukes to deflect or disrupt an asteroid, however, is widely considered to be a red tape-wrapped last resort, a desperate Hail Mary lobbed toward an imminent threat that astronomers detected far too late for other more subtle interventions to suffice. A kinetic impactor is what we think of right now as our top solution, said Christina Thomas, a planetary astronomer at Northern Arizona University. In other words, using a speedy but inert projectile to deflect an asteroid many years in advance. Scientists have simulated playing billiards with asteroids countless times, but there is only one way to know for certain whether we can fling one out of Earth's way. Venture into the darkness, find an asteroid, and give it a good thwack. Dart a car-sized box with two wing-like solar panels will soon be heading toward a binary asteroid system. Didymus, nearly 800 meters across, is orbited by a moonlet, Dimorphos, which is 160 meters long. The little moonlet is Dart's target. About a month out, Didymus will just barely register in Dart's camera. 4 hours prior to impact, the spacecraft's guidance system, a technological cousin of those used to steer missiles on Earth, takes the wheel and guides us in, Rivkin says. Shortly thereafter, Dimorphos will swim into view as a blurry but distinct speck of light. About 2 minutes out, Rivkin explains, the autonomous pilot takes its hand off the wheel and its foot off the brakes. DART will take and transmit snapshots of its rapidly approaching final destination until the very last instant, before disintegrating into a cloud of shrapnel and superheated plasma in an epic but entirely noiseless collision. In space, no one can hear you go boom. Ideally, DART's momentum gets transferred to Dimorphos, leaving behind an impact crater and shifting the moonlet's almost 12-hour orbit around Didymus by at least 73 seconds. A pint-sized CubeSat released by DART 10 days prior will observe the violence up close, while ground-based astronomers keep an eye on the binary asteroid system from afar until it fades from view in spring 2023. Astronomers cycled through several target candidates for DART, but settled on Dimorphos for several reasons. The first one is safety. Changing Dimorphos' orbit cannot change the orbit of Didymus to put it on an intersecting path with the Earth. The second is that Dimorphos is a bit like the hand on a massive clock. With Didymus in the clock's center, astronomers on Earth will be able to easily see if the hand is ticking around the clock differently post-impact. 2 months of observations will reveal how effective the deflection has been. Dimorphos is also in the size range of asteroids that can squash entire cities, putting it in the sweet spot from a planetary defense perspective, Thomas says. However, asteroids hold disquieting structural surprises. When NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft briefly touched down on the asteroid Bennu in 2020 to grab some rock samples, it almost sank into the target spot as if the surface were composed of melted butter, said Patrick Michael, the principal investigator of Hera, a follow-up ESA-led mission, slated to arrive at Didymus in 2026 to examine DART's consequences up close. Asteroids lacking sufficient gravity to squeeze their innards, perhaps including those city killers 1 kilometer or less in size, could be like rocks flying in formation, Bannister says. So when trying to deflect a city killer, Bannister says, perhaps we should be thinking, how do you move a school of fish, not how do you throw a mountain? All of this is pertinent to DART. Megan Bruck-Sile, a planetary defense researcher at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, has repeatedly simulated its fated impact. On the surface, the DART experiment seems really simple, she says, but only one thing is certain. No outcome is assured because so many of Dimorphos' fundamental properties remain unknown. Mission planners are reasonably confident that DART's hushed demise will successfully convey a billiard-like kick to Dimorphos, which seems hefty enough to be sufficiently squeezed by gravity's clutches. But in the case of a slightly less substantial object, a kinetic impactor could just shoot right through, like a bullet through cake, blowing it into small but still dangerous chunks. A successful deflection of such threats could require multiple, more gentle impacts rather than a one-and-done wallop. Another huge unknown is Dimorphos' appearance. It could be shaped like a potato, a dog bone, a rubber duck, 2 bowling balls stuck together, or something else entirely. A colleague recently gifted Adams a donut-shaped fridge magnet and a wink to how often asteroids surprise scientists, once unveiled up close by some deep space robotic emissary. A near spherical or even potato-like shape would be optimal for a clean hit, whereas the uneven distribution of mass from more complex morphologies would raise the chance of a glancing blow, one that could just spin up the moonlet and not actually change its orbit, says Oliver Dweck, a systems engineering researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In the specific and benign case of Dimorphos, all these uncertainties are mostly academic. But in the event of a deflection attempt for a true city killer, they could prove critical. We could, for instance, successfully deflect a potentially hazardous asteroid, only to inadvertently put it on a new orbit that makes it more likely to hit Earth in the long run. There are points in space around our planet known as gravitational keyholes, wherein Earth's pull on the asteroids sets the errant space rock on an assuredly destructive journey. Once you go through a keyhole, the probability of hitting the Earth is virtually 100%, says Dweck. This, to put it mildly, constitutes a major hurdle for any preemptive strikes against nascent impact threats. The total budget for the DART mission is about $320 million, which is not even the cost of a football stadium, Michael says. If DART succeeds in deflecting Dimorphos, then a possible near-term future in which many DART-like missions remains on standby, each ready to launch on one of several readily available commercial spacecraft, is easy to envisage. But it's not enough to demonstrate technology, Michael says. The world still needs to set up a system in which the entire planet responds to the threat of an incoming asteroid in as much unison as possible. Which country or countries should be involved in the deflection or disruption attempt? At present, although many nations are involved in the search for near-Earth objects and are participating in DART and HERA, America is leading the way on asteroid deflection technology. Which countries should aid in any possible impact zone evacuations? When and how should the world decide that trying to deflect or disrupt an asteroid is riskier than simply letting it hit and then assisting the affected nations in their effort to rebuild? Working groups at the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs, as well as a biennial tabletop exercise that role-play a potential asteroid impact, are making earnest, but so far paltry, efforts at answering these sorts of enormous questions. Humanity is some way off from having a full-blown asteroid protection network, but DART's launch is another key milestone in the evolution of planetary defense, once seen as esoteric and perhaps a little silly. When I was in graduate school in the 1990s, there was a small number of people who were interested, and everyone else treated it as kind of a crank field, Rifkin said. But so was astrobiology. And now space science is consumed by the interplanetary and even interstellar search for alien life. Thanks to the Chelyabinsk event and other dramatic close encounters with impactors, planetary defense itself has also undergone a real sea change, Rifkin says. And for what may well be the first time ever in Earth's multi-billion year history, some of its inhabitants could soon no longer be powerless against an insidious cosmic threat. If it's one thing that anxious people have to worry about when they're trying to sleep, I think that's worth it, says Rifkin. It's one less piece of existential dread. A version of this story originally appeared in Scientific American. We're going to read both of the obituaries this week, starting with the World War II hero who became a Senate stalwart, Bob Dole, 1923 to 2021. Bob Dole was half dead when he came back from World War II, lacerated by shrapnel on the battlefields of Italy. His once strapping body was withered and encased in plaster. Dole spent the next 3 years fighting for his life and then learning to move again, though he never regained the use of his right arm. But driven by an unbreakable will, the son of Kansas Prairie went on to become a titan of American politics, serving 8 years in the House of Representatives and 27 in the Senate. Initially a snarling arch-conservative, Dole, who was GOP Senate leader for a then-record 11 years, came to value compromise over ideological stubbornness. He proved to be a master dealmaker, helping to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act, President Ronald Reagan's tax cuts, expansions to food stamps and Medicaid, and the North American Free Trade Agreement. But viewed by many voters as a humorless Washington insider, Dole struck out in repeated White House bids, failing to win the GOP nomination in 1980 and 1988, and the presidency in 1996. Only after he left politics did the public get to see his sardonic and self-deprecating personality. I slept like a baby, he said after his 1996 loss, adding, woke up crying every 2 hours. Dole was born in dust storm blackened Russell, Kansas, to a mother who sold sewing machines and a father who worked in a creamery, said the New York Times. A gifted athlete, he earned a spot on Fog Allen's legendary University of Kansas basketball team and had dreams of becoming a surgeon. Following the outbreak of World War II, Dole joined the Army with hopes of training as a doctor, but instead was made a second lieutenant in the infantry. While fighting outside the small Italian town of Casteldiano, Dole was rushing to help a soldier hit by German fire when shrapnel blew apart his right shoulder and arm and broke several vertebrae in his neck and spine. Back in the U.S., the people of Russell collected money in cigar boxes to help pay for reconstructive surgery, said the Washington Post. With a medical career now impossible, Dole studied law at Washburn University and was encouraged to run for office by Kansas Republicans, who thought the war hero a sure winner. After a stint as a Kansas legislator and county attorney, he won a U.S. House seat in 1960 and moved into the Senate in 1968, said the Associated Press. A close ally of President Richard Nixon, who would dispatch Dole to the Senate floor to assail Vietnam War critics, he was tainted by Watergate and seemed doomed to lose his Senate seat in 1974. But he was narrowly reelected after claiming his Democratic opponent, an obstetrician, delivered abortions on demand. President Gerald Ford tapped Dole to be his tough guy running mate in 1976, but Dole went too far, claiming in a vice presidential debate that all the U.S. wars of the 20th century were Democrat wars. His opponent, Senator Walter Mondale, responded that Dole has richly earned his reputation as a hatchet man. As the country swung to the right in the Reagan years, Dole's reputation recovered, said The Guardian. He thrived as Finance Committee Chair in the Reagan era and finally secured the GOP presidential nomination in 1996. But Dole seemed wholly unable to mount a credible campaign against an ostensibly vulnerable President Bill Clinton. He had no clear agenda and was successfully portrayed by Clinton as old. The GOP nominee was 73 at the time and out of touch, said Politico.com. Clinton won handily. Dole went on to become a high-powered Washington lawyer and remained fiercely loyal to his party. He was the only former GOP presidential candidate to endorse Donald Trump in 2016 and again in 2020. In an op-ed published this week, Dole called for Republicans and Democrats to abandon bitter partisanship and work together. I cannot pretend that I have not been a loyal champion for my party, he wrote, but I always served my country best when I did so first and foremost as an American. The tenacious golfer who desegregated the Masters. Lee Elder, 1934 to 2021. Lee Elder had to overcome more than bunkers and water hazards when he teed off at the 1975 Masters in Augusta, Georgia. First black golfer to compete in what had been an exclusively white tournament, Elder was flooded with death threats in the run-up to the championship. One harasser warned he ought to check behind every tree on the course to thwart potential attacks. Elder moved between two rented houses in Augusta. But on the green, the mood was jubilant. The mostly black staff of the Augusta National Golf Club, which wouldn't accept its first black member for another 15 years, had left their posts to line the fairway and cheer for him. I couldn't hold back the tears, he recalled in 2019. Of all the acknowledgments of what I had accomplished by getting there, this one meant the most. Born in Dallas, the youngest of 10 children, Elder had a turbulent start in life, said the Washington Post. Orphaned at age 9, he dropped out of school in 10th grade and supported himself as a caddy and a golf hustler, often working with Titanic Thompson, a notorious gambler and golfer. Thompson, who was white, would take wagers that he and his chauffeur, Elder in uniform, could defeat the two best players on the course. They normally did. Elder's raw talent earned him entry into the United Golfers Association, the black equivalent of the whites-only PGA. He won 21 out of 23 UGA tournaments in one stretch, and in 1968 made it into the PGA, which desegregated in 1961. The highlight of his rookie year came at the American Golf Classic in Akron, Ohio, where he tied with golfing legend Jack Nicklaus after 72 holes, losing only in a sudden-death playoff, said the Associated Press. But Elder suffered a continual string of indignities, including being forced to change clothes in the parking lot at White's only clubhouses. He missed the cut at his first master, said the Daily Telegraph, but he played in five more, and he made history again in 1979 when he became the first black golfer to qualify for the U.S. Ryder Cup team. After retiring, he continued to speak out against racism and especially against country clubs that denied membership to African Americans. He felt an immense sense of hope in 1997 when he watched Tiger Woods triumph at the Masters. If the 21-year-old managed to win, Elder had told a reporter earlier that day, no one will turn their head when a black man walks to the first tee. On the Talking Points page, we have abortion rights, what a rollback of Roe would mean. It's time to contemplate a world after Roe, said Amy Davidson Sorkin in NewYorker.com. During oral arguments last week in the case of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which concerns a Mississippi law banning abortion after 15 weeks, the conservative-dominated Supreme Court gave every indication it's ready to overturn both Roe v. Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood, the landmark decisions that enshrined reproductive rights and access to abortion. The court may take a less drastic course, leaving Roe in place, but rendering its protections mostly meaningless by upholding the Mississippi law. But either way, the right to an abortion as Americans have known it for half a century would vanish. Such a seismic shift would trigger a political earthquake just months before the 2022 midterm elections, said Dan Baltz in the Washington Post. Abortion access would become an issue for states to decide, resulting in an intensification of the country's cultural wars and a red-blue patchwork of abortion rights and restrictions. In purple states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, attempts to ban abortion may set off a titanic struggle. The right to a safe legal abortion is no mere culture war issue, said Jill Filipovich in CNN.com. It's a fundamental question of health care access that enables women's physical safety and personal freedom. Republicans may soon find out how enraged women become when our rights to our own bodies are taken away by five or six conservative judges who are unaccountable to the voting public. If the conservative justices simply throw out a half century of legal precedent, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial, the court's credibility will be seriously damaged. In Roe, the court recognized that the 14th Amendment's guarantee of personal liberty includes a woman's control over her own body. If Justices Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch, all appointed by President Trump, provide the votes to end Roe, it will be clear they are reasoning backward from their own personal political beliefs. During last week's hearing, Liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor was correct to question whether the court can survive the stench resulting from public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts. Stop telling us overturning Roe would be radical, said Matt Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. What's radical is nine justices unilaterally imposing a top-down law under the guise of a purely fictional right to privacy. Overturning that flawed ruling wouldn't ban abortion in any case. It would just send the issue back to the states to decide via the democratic process, which is where it belongs. Let's not skate around the core issue, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Amid all the sparring over precedents and politics, few people want to actually debate abortion itself. But the promise of protection from lethal violence is at the core of our legal system, and it's undeniable that abortion is a form of killing that violates the basic protection, snuffing out a distinct human organism that comes into existence at conception. Not everyone shares the belief that human life begins at conception, said William Salatin in Slate.com, and most Americans don't want the government to decide that question. In a recent poll, three-quarters of voters said such decisions should be left to the woman and her doctor. In a Navigator poll in September, only 23% said abortion should be legal. Even many Americans who personally oppose abortion are uncomfortable with banning it, and a rollback of Roe would likely trigger a voter backlash in next year's midterms. Don't be so sure, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. Yes, the initial reaction would be thermonuclear, but a messy patchwork of legal abortion in blue states and abortion bans in red states would be a compromise that might prove broadly acceptable to most people, even if it's not morally or logically coherent. I doubt it, said David Brooks in the New York Times. Extremists on both sides elide the hard and complex issues involved, with conservatives steamrolling over the issues of women's autonomy, while progressives fail to recognize the fetus at all. Meanwhile, most Americans like me occupy an ambivalent majority in favor of some abortion restrictions, but against a ban. This is a miserably complex issue, but in our incendiary political culture, even small battles take on huge significance, and no one is in the mood to compromise. Well, with that, we have actually run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.